Country entertainers have been both rural and working class. But when they musically reminisce about their origins, their songs evoke not the labor that filled much of their early lives, but the rural context in which that labor was embedded. Some songs and much country humor recall the painful or unpleasant aspects of rural life, but most often, country lyrics pay homage to a more wholesome country past.
For many years, country music has been the largest selling format for radio and purveyors of recordings. What accounts for its broad appeal? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
Did country music evolve from folk music and popular tunes, or did it arrive on the scene as a product of the recording industry and radio? What's the connection between music of labor and music of protest? Does country music have a political point of view? For that matter, is there still such a thing as country music? Our guest is Bill Malone, professor emeritus at Tulane University and a historian specializing in country music and other forms of traditional American music. He's also the author of Country Music USA, which was the first definitive academic history of country music, and Don't Get Above Your Raisin, Country Music and the Southern Working Class, published by the University of Illinois Press.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start with your title, Don't Get Above Your Raisin, Country Music and the Southern Working Class? Tell me about that title.
Well, I think that's a term that a lot of country and working class kids have heard as they're growing up. You know, just don't forget where you come from. Don't forget your roots, and don't get too highfalutin, because you might come down pretty fast. That's something my father always warned me against. You know, he grew up as a product of the Depression, and actually pre-Depression years, and he didn't want his sons to go out on a limb too much.
Well, and you found a way to combine it. I was just thinking to do an academic work on country music is a way of sort of not getting above your raisin in a sense, but paying homage to it.
Yeah. I guess in some ways I did. If not above my raisin, I got apart from it just by making the decision to go off to college. I was persistent in my desires to go down to the University of Texas. My parents would have been happy if I'd just taken a short 6 months or 9 months course in business training and become a bookkeeper for somebody. You know, I could have dressed nicely with a white shirt each day and made more money than they ever made. But I wanted to go to the university, and so I went down there and stayed for a long time. And the one thing my relatives always asked, any time they'd see my parents and ask about me, they'd say, is Billy about through down there at the university? Year after year after year.
At what point did you get interested in country music, and then what did your university experience teach you about it?
Well, I grew up with country music. I always point to that one day in our life when Daddy brought the Philco battery-powered radio into the house, and we started listening to the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. You know, the Grand Ole Opry just achieved its network status that same year, 1939. But we also heard the hillbilly shows from Dallas and Fort Worth and Tulsa and Shreveport. So it was a constant presence in our house. And before that, my mother sang old-time songs, and of course, we didn't know where they came from. They very likely were learned from the radio, not from the radio, but from commercial sources.
It was certainly all over the radio by 1939. I mean, you had those border blasters in the few years before that from just south of the Rio Grande.
And faithfully, my brother would tune in, XCRF, from Villa Acuña, to listen to the Carter family. So they were in the household by 1939, 1940, along with Cowboy Slim Reinhart and the Chuck Wagon Gang and Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and on.
Did you combine then your university studies? I know you went into history eventually, but at what point did you mix the academic and the study?
I never had any idea. I never had the remotest idea that you could write on something you love. Because all my friends down at the university were writing on topics like abandoned short line railroads and crude oil pipelines. Because the professor that I decided to work under, Joe Franz, was a business historian, and he wanted me to do something in business history. But on the other hand, I sang all the time. I'd sing in the halls and in the graduate school office. And with some of my friends, we began singing at a honky-tonk, I guess you'd call it that, or at least a bar out on the north side of Austin called Threadgill's. That's the place where Janis Joplin first sang when she came to Austin.
Wow.
And I remember well the night she came in with a little group that called themselves the Waller Creek Boys. But we'd go out once or twice a week there at the end of the 50s, early 60s, singing all the old Ernest Tubb and Hank Williams and Roy Acuff songs I'd grown up with. And gradually songs from the folk revival began to come in, because that's just about 1959 or so was when the New Lost City Ramblers made their first recordings, began to listen to them. And I'd already discovered the Harry Smith Anthology, that seminal boxed collection of records that from the Harry Smith private collection. But Folkways produced them. They'd been 78 RPMs, but he produced them on LPs.
Sure, Folkways.
And they've stayed in print ever since.
That brings up the question of the difference between folk and country, or just how you would define country music.
To me, folk music is music that just sort of evolved over the years, orally, generally, although people learn from songbooks, too, whatever source they could find a song. And they were passed on from generation to generation. And that's the music that country music drew upon when it began to be commercialized in the 20s. In fact, Columbia, which was one of the companies that began producing these old-time songs, referred to the songs in its catalogs as old familiar tunes. And I think that's a very good description for the music, because people were singing and playing songs that they had grown up with, songs they knew in their communities. And if you look at those songs carefully, which they didn't do because they didn't have to, but if you look at it from a scholarly point of view, you'll find that a lot of those songs came from Tin Pan Alley. They came from commercial sources. They were written by pop songwriters in many cases. Many of them were old British ballads, but a lot of them were gospel songs coming from the old shape note paperback hymnals. But it didn't matter where they came from. These were just songs that were floating around that people knew, often in fragmentary form. And so when they got the opportunity to make records in the mid-1920s and to play on radio stations, which happened at the same time, they utilized this old material. So in that way, sort of seamlessly, the old folk music evolved into what they didn't know what to call it. Hillbilly was a popular term. That's the term I grew up with. But it really wasn't until the 1940s that country music, that the label country music was affixed to this music. And by that time, of course, the music was becoming a big business.
One of the songs that tumbled through from, I guess not terribly early, since it's about a railroad, into early country music was John Henry.
John Henry very well may be the most popular song in America. It's the most often played song in early country music. You could never hear a broadcast of the Grand Ole Opry, for example, without hearing somebody do John Henry. Often it was done in instrumental fashion with no words at all, or they might sing it as a blues, or they might speed it up and make it into what we would now call a bluegrass tune. But it was very popular. And I think the reason it was popular is because it just played so many roles. On one hand, it was a kind of a glorification of labor,
right,
but it was also a tribute to liberty.
Individuality.
So you could respond to it on many different levels. It's a work song, but it's also a song of freedom and a song of masculine power.
Catchy tune, too. Didn't hurt.
And do you have a recording we can hear?
One of my favorite recordings, because he has a little something to say about it before he goes into the song itself, is the recording made by Merle Travis in 1947. Merle Travis is best known for his guitar playing. What he did is, it's often called a thumb style, but it's usually he keeps the rhythm going on the bass strings with his thumb and picks out the melody on one finger.
Mm.
And when Chet Atkins heard that just over the radio, he thought Merle must have been using three or four fingers, because he was achieving such a syncopated and multi-leveled style. But in 1947, Merle's recording director at Capitol Records in California, he said to Merle, you ought to record some folk songs. They're beginning to be pretty popular. And he was thinking mainly of Burl Ives, who had already built a pretty successful career. Merle's first response was, I don't know any folk songs, which wasn't true. Of course, he did.
He just didn't know that he knew them.
Yeah. So, but anyway, he said, I can write better songs than I grew up with. So he started writing songs. One of them was 16 Tons, one of the greatest commercial hits in
big
America.
Big hit for Tennessee Ernie Ford.
And that went into an album called Folk Songs from the Hills, along with Dark as a Dungeon and John Henry, I believe. I hope I'm not off there. John Henry came about the same time. But anyway, it's just a rollicking tune the way Merle Travis did it. But it's still, it's a great tribute to working people.
John Henry was a steel-driving man, drove steel all over the land. Said, before I let a steam a hammer get me down, I'm gonna die with my hammer in my hand, Lord, Lord. Die with my hammer in my hand. Ever since I've been big enough to remember hearing anybody sing anything at all, I believe I've heard that old song about the strong man that hammered himself to death on the railroad. John Henry was his name. There's been dozens and dozens of different tales about where John Henry come from. The Southern folks claims he was an iron worker from Birmingham. The West claims that he worked on the Santa Fe Railroad in the early days. And I've heard the East Kentucky coal miners claim that John Henry was one of their very own. I don't know myself where in the world John Henry come from, but according to this song, he was a good un. When John Henry was a little bitty boy, no bigger than the palm of your hand, his mammy, she looked down at Johnny and said, my Johnny gonna be a steel-driving man, Lord, Lord. Johnny gonna be a steel-driving man. When John Henry was a little bitty boy, sitting on his mammy's knee, well, he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel and said, this hammer gonna be the death, Lord, of me, Lord, Lord. This hammer gonna be the death of me. Was a steel-driving man, drove steel all over the land. Said, before I let a steam hammer get me down, I'm gonna die with my hammer in my hand, Lord, Lord. Die with my hammer in my hand. Well, Johnny went to the tunnel to drive a steam hammer by his side. He beat the steam hammer to the top of the hill, and then he laid down his hammer and he cried, Lord, Lord, laid down his hammer and he cried. Well, John Henry had a loving little wife. Her name was Polly Ann. Well, Johnny got sick and he had to go to bed. And Polly drove steel like a man, Lord, Lord. Polly drove steel like a man.
Merle Travis with a kind of a female empowerment twist at
right.
The end there. I can almost see Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah.
And his take on John Henry, the often done John Henry.
We think of country music as being Southern. To what extent is it exclusively Southern, would you say, in its origins?
I wouldn't say it was exclusively Southern, but it was largely Southern. And I like to explain it this way. There was rural music all over North America, from Canada down to the Mexican border. You could find fiddlers, ballad singers, occasional string bands, gospel singers. But there's a difference between rural music and country music. Country music is the term that was applied to once aspects of this music began to be commercialized. And it may be largely an accident of history, but the first people to make records and the first people to be heard on radio were in the South. And I think they stamped their styles upon the music, and that's affected it ever since. And one reason why the recording engineers came South is because the South, for a long time, had had this reputation as being a very musical region. It goes back to Stephen Foster earlier. The Blackface Minstrels, you know, claimed that their music came out of Southern culture. And then throughout the 19th century, Foster was only one of several writers, many of them later on Tin Pan Alley, who wrote songs like Are You From Dixie? and that sort of thing, because it was just the South had such a romantic, exerted such a romantic fascination for people. So I think when people began looking for fiddlers and string bands in the 1920s, they went south. Who knows? If they'd gone to South Dakota, they might have found
more accordions.
Yeah, I always argue, too, that although in part it was an accident of history, I just think Southern music is more interesting than other regional forms of music. And that's because of that conjoining of the African-American tradition with white European music. It's, the African admixture is really what made it interesting.
Where did the blues come into it?
From the very beginning. From the time this music was recorded in the 20s, you find all kinds of songs being labeled as blues tunes. Sometimes they're not true blues, but blues will show up in the title. Because white Southerners grew up hearing black music all the time, gospel music and blues music and other secular forms. And so they absorbed that into their own styles, and particularly when white singers wanted to be a little bit naughty or risque or rowdy.
That's true, isn't it?
They retreated to the black form. Of course, the other thing, it was the gospel music. I don't think that gospel music exerted nearly as profound an impact on music in the North as it did in the South. So those two factors, the African-American admixture and the gospel theme.
So something like Weave Room Blues, is that from a black origin?
Or no, it was actually written by a fellow named Dorsey Dixon, who was a lifelong textile worker, just as his brother Howard was. And I think the single largest body of work songs that developed in country music came out of the cotton mill tradition. You find a lot of cotton mill songs, and of course today you find truck driving songs, that sort of thing. But in the 1930s and 40s, the cotton mill songs were the ones that predominated. It's got a lot of rural people moved into the mills. They created a new community there, and they sang, they played, they formed string bands as a way of finding diversion from their work. Cotton mill life was pretty tough, and a lot of these workers regretted ever having left the farm. They'd been lured into the mills, you know, because there's a chance to make a little money.
Make a little more money, yeah.
And what should we listen for as we hear Weave Room Blues?
Well, for one thing, we will hear an example of what Norman was referring to. You'll hear some black style. It won't necessarily sound black to us. But the fact that the Dixons borrowed the term blues, the blues style, you know, it shows that, again, just how strong the African-American influence was. But this is an indictment of cotton mill life. The Dixons really never left that life behind, although they tried to make music as much as they could. But this shows that not all Southerners worked on farms, and industrial life was transforming the region by the 1920s, and this is a good example of one of those early topical songs.
Working in a weed room, fighting for my life, trying to make a living for my kiddies and my wife. Some are needing clothing and some are needing shoes, but I'm getting nothing but them weed room blues. I've got the blues, I've got the blues, I've got them all full of weed room blues. I've got the blues, the weed room blues. Your loom to slamming shettles bouncing in the floor, and when you flag your fixer you can see that he is sore. I'm trying to make a living but I'm thinking I will lose, for I'm going crazy with them weave room blues. I've got the blues, I've got the blues, I've got them all full of weave room blues. I've got the blues, the weave room blues. The harness eyes are breaking with the doubles coming through. The devil's in your alley and he's coming after you. Our hearts are aching, let us take a little booze, for we're going crazy with them weave room blues. I've got the blues, I've got the blues, I've got them all for weave room blues. I've got the blues, the weave room blues. breakouts, mat up by the score. Cloth all rolled back and piled up in the floor. The bats are running empty, strings are hanging to your shoes. I'm simply dying with them wee broom blues. I've got the blues, I've got the blues. I've got the awful wee broom blues. I've got the blues, wee broom blues.
Quite the guitar technique there, too, the slide guitar.
Yeah, and I guess you might call that another example of African-American influence.
Swiss yodeling in there, too.
Right. Yeah.
And not exactly blues, and you're right, Bill, in the sense that we would think of it, but yet the lyrics are still in that category.
Mm-hmm. But the recording shows the eclecticism of what was then called hillbilly music. They borrowed from every imaginable source. So it's just like musicians have always done. If you hear something, you like it. It doesn't matter where it comes from. The only people who really worry about that.
The producers.
are critics later on. Uh-huh. Are fans who want the musicians to stay in one mold forever and not really change.
We're going to look more at the history of country music when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Bill Malone, who's filling us in about some of the roots of country music, and particularly country music in terms of labor and protest. And we just heard a tune that sounds like it could yield some protest, the Weave Room Blues. But what's the difference between, you know, this kind of protest song and something that you would associate with more of a movement?
I think Weave Room Blues was just a statement about the conditions of life, just describing what it was like to work in a cotton mill, but you don't find any call there for protest. It is protest, but you don't find a call for action, either politically or economically, although there have been some songs like that in the music. But I guess the first thing we should say is that country singers and songwriters haven't talked all that much about work. Work is taken for granted. It's just something that defines one life. But when they make songs, they'll generally try to say something that will be diverting or entertaining. Truck drivers, for example, don't necessarily want to hear songs about truck driving life.
They might rather hear about love or
yeah.
something like
yeah.
that.
The basic things in life, and that's what country songs usually do. But you will find quite a few songs that pay tribute to working people. Well, we've already heard one like John Henry, but a song like George Jones' Small Time Laboring Man is just a statement by this dependable worker. He goes about his job. He tries to do it well, although it's not always a rosy life. But he does it because it's just something has to be done to keep his family fed and keep his home intact.
So he's celebrating labor, even though it might have a downside to it.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we need to know about George Jones as a figure?
George Jones is the greatest country singer of all, I think.
You heard it here.
I might find some argument on that, but I don't think that anybody's ever been able to use his voice the way that George has. He hasn't written many songs. He did in his early career, but usually he's been so successful as a writer that the good writers are always just chomping at the bit to provide him with songs. And I have to say, I don't recall who wrote this particular song we're going to hear, but I think it's just a good example of this faithful, dependable, but stick to it type of worker.
The small-time laboring man. George Jones.
A dollar an hour, 8 hours a day, will soon make a young man wither away. I work for my family with my wrinkled hands, for I'm a small-time laboring man. 6 long days each week. I toil and I sweat, but on Sundays my family gives me comfort and rest. Then again Monday morning I'll make tracks in the sand, for I'm a small time laboring man. I'm a small time laboring man, fighting against crime more than I can. I'd fight for my country with my calloused hand, for I'm a small time laboring man. 12 long months each year my life stays the same, making my honest dollar in the sun, snow, and rain. No, you don't see my family on the starvation plan, for I'm a small time laboring man.
One thing I notice about the lyrics of that one is that despite registering dissatisfaction, the withering away with the low pay and so on, he says, I fight for my country, you know, I get comfort on Sundays. Yeah. There's sort of an acceptance built in, too.
Yeah, part fatalism, maybe.
Where do women come into the labor singing?
Women provided the linchpin of this music. Quite often, they were the people from whom these musicians learned, not simply how to sing, because the mother is the first person you hear singing at home. And so I think a lot of her style is bound to rub off on the singers. But in case after case, you'll also find people like Ralph Stanley, the great banjo player, saying that he first learned his first chords on the banjo from his mother. There's example after example of that. But women were discouraged from going out on the concert trail. They could sing at home. They could sing at church. That was perfectly acceptable.
Or in a group with, like, the Carter family.
Yeah. When they played with men, the men got top billing. It was Johnny and Jack and the Tennessee Mountain Boys and Miss Kitty Wells, although she was definitely the one with the talent in the group. And for a long, long time, bands had what they called their girl singers. So it was a hard row for women to follow.
Where does working girl blues come out of that tradition?
I think it was a response to that kind of life and the kind of life that Hazel Dickens found in the honky-tonks. She said she became a feminist songwriter because the way women were treated in the bars. She said, particularly the old boys from back home, if women came into the honky-tonks, they wanted to exploit them in some way or take them home, you know, with them. But if they tried to front their own bands or if they tried to be assertive in their music, the good old boys were kind of skeptical of that.
I enjoyed the book you wrote in conjunction with her called Working Girl Blues, The Life and Music of Hazel Dickens, but interesting life sort of behind her songs. As we hear Working Girl Blues, what should we listen for in Hazel Dickens singing?
I've often wondered, and I forgot to ask her this when I was writing the book, I wonder if this is a response to Merle Haggard's Working Man's Blues. Because in that song, you know, he adopts a very individualistic point of view. He's the master of his own fate, you know, and I've never lived on welfare. That's one thing I won't do, you know, but I'll keep working and drop off at the bar room. I think she's much more realistic. She's saying that it's not that easy to make it on your own. And as I said, she had found discrimination in her work, but she also found it in the workplace. She had worked in factories, a lot of places, before she ever became a musician. So I think you're going to hear defiance in this song, but you're also going to hear a very realistic depiction of what it's like to be in the workplace, whether you're woman or man. Working Girl Blues.
Hazel Dickens.
Hey, 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 got the early Monday morning.
put on my ragged, worn-out working shoes. Well, the weekend was too short, but I can't choose. When the Lord made the working girl, he made the blues.
Well, she'll cite some, you know, class differences there between labor and management or ownership, but she's still not calling for action.
But she does in other songs.
I was going to ask you about the politics of some of these songs because, you know, if we didn't have our stereotyped assumption that country music often goes with political conservatism, it almost sounds some of it could be used by Marxists or by liberals. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can take those lyrics and...
That's right, and it has been, yeah.
You can use it in different ways.
Pete Seeger has been using this music for how long now? Since the early 40s, at
yeah,
least?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And his brother, Mike, whom I'm now writing on, you know, avoided political involvement. He felt if you just sing songs from poor people, working people, that's a political statement in itself. You don't have to come up with these overt songs of class consciousness or class militants. You lend prestige, you lend respect to these people by using their music and playing the songs the way they played them.
The lyrics speak for themselves,
mm-hmm.
you mean? Another song that you mentioned by Hazel Dickens is Black Lung. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Hazel was politicized by several things. She was got involved in a group called the Southern Folk Culture Project, along with Bernice Reagan and Anne Romaine. In the mid and late 60s, right in the heart of the civil rights conflict in the South, they began taking musical tours into the South and playing before biracial arguments. They were definitely trying to make a political statement, show that these musical forms were not divided from each other. They were divided, but at the same time, they were interrelated because whites and blacks had learned from each other. So they took them to biracial audiences. But during the tours, she began to see how this music could be used. She became more proud of her roots. She'd been a bit shamed of having grown up poor and barefooted in West Virginia. And so she now began to feel that no need to be ashamed of that. Let's go out and try to do something for them. Because along with the music, they would sit around and workshop, sit in a circle and talk about their experiences. But more dramatically, she got politicized by what was happening to her family. It all had been uprooted from their rural past, but at least one of her brothers died from pneumoconiosis or black lung, and she had other relatives who died from the disease. And so Hazel began singing for union groups. In fact, she was introduced to the American public through that great documentary film, Harlan County, USA. If people haven't seen that, I really recommend it. She was pretty much the soundtrack of that movie. And so after that, she ceased to be just a bluegrass singer. She became a protest singer and a spokesman for working class rights. And Black Lung was one of the responses. She began to sing that song, union rallies and strikes all over the South and the Upper South.
He's had more hard luck than most men could stand. The mines was his first love, but never his friend. He's lived a hard life, and hard he'll die. Black Lung's done got him. His time is nigh. Black Lung, Black Lung, you're just biding your time. Soon all this suffering I'll leave behind. But I can't help but wonder what God had in mind to send such a devil to claim this soul of mine. He went to the boss man, but he closed the door. Well, it seems you're not wanted when you're sick and you're poor. You're not even covered in their medical plans, and your life depends on the favors of man. Down in the poorhouse on starvation's plan, where pride is a stranger and doomed is a man, his soul full of coal dust till his body's decayed. And everyone but Black Lung's done turned him away. Black Lung, Black Lung, oh, your hands I see cold. As you reach for my life and you torture my soul, cold as that water hole down in that dark cave where I spent my life's blood digging my own grave. Down at the graveyard the boss man came with his little bunch of flowers. Dear God, what a shame. Take back those flowers. Don't you sing no sad songs. The die has been cast now. A good man is gone.
Hazel Dickens and nothing but Hazel Dickens with Black Lung. We'll have a couple more songs and insights from our guest about country music when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Bill Malone, who's the author of numerous books, including Don't Get Above Your Raisin, Country Music and the Southern Working Class, and also Working Girl Blues, The Life and Music of Hazel Dickens. Are there common themes that you find running through country music?
Well, off air, Norman referred to this song by David Allan Coe, Never Even Call Me By My Name. The song was written by Steve Goodman in Chicago, and he had sent that song to David Allan Coe saying, I've written the perfect country song. And then Coe wrote back to him and said, you have not written the perfect country song. There's nothing about mama. There's nothing about prison and so on. And so Steve Goodman rewrote it. He said, I was drunk the day my mom got out of prison, and I went to pick her up in the rain. But before I could get to the station in my pickup truck, she got run over by a damned old train, etc.
Soon to come out on the University of the Air label.
So that doesn't cover all the bases, but
it covers
a lot of them in one verse.
And most songs are love songs. That's probably true with all popular music forms. When I call country music a working class music, I'm not arguing that it's out there militantly battling for working class rights, which I wish it would sometimes, you know. I think it's working class just because it addresses the common everyday problems that people face. Just giving your kids an education, just putting food on the table, holding your marriage together, being a good citizen, surviving. And survival takes many forms. Sometimes it's through realistic responses, sometimes through escape. There's a lot of escapism in country music expressed in drinking songs and dancing songs and religious songs and sometimes songs of violence and that sort of thing. But I think whether it's being escapist or whether it's being realistic, I think the music still pretty realistically approaches the concerns that most of us have.
Is there a song that epitomizes that for you?
I've always thought that Merle Haggard's The Way I Am does that. And it's interesting because he didn't write it. It was written by Sonny Throckmorton, one of the best songwriters in Nashville. And we know Haggard as a person who's written great songs of social comment. One of the greatest songs was Mama's Hungry Eyes, about growing up in a poor family in California and seeing what it did to his mother. And militant songs like A Working Man Can't Get Nowhere Today, that sort of thing. But I think he comes closest to the universal condition and the dreams, the failed dreams quite often of people in this song called The Way I Am. Sonny Throckmorton, but we hear Merle Haggard doing it.
Wish I were down on some blue bayou with a bamboo cane stuck in the sand. But the road I'm on don't seem to go there. So I just dream, keep on being the way I am. Wish I enjoyed what makes my living, did what I do with a willing hand. Some would run, but that ain't like me. So I just dream and keep on being the way I am. The way I am don't fit my shackles. The way I am, reality. I can almost see that barber dancing. But I just dream, keep on being the way I am. Thank you. just dream, keep on being the way I am. I just dream, keep on being the way I am. Dearly,
was certainly a statement of individuality, isn't it? You just keep on being the way you are.
It's individuality, but it's individuality without a necessarily a positive resolution.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's right.
Maybe a dead-end job he's in, but he's going to still be there.
He's going to accept it.
Yeah.
Do you see any sort of change as you move further along? In other words, more recent country songs. Do you hear something different?
Yeah, I think country music has always been working class, but it wasn't self-consciously so until the 1980s on. And I think that came about in large part because country music was discovered by the media and it began to get a lot of press. And a lot of people came, like Johnny Cash, came along and, you know, won over a strong youth audience. He did more so than anybody else did. But I think coming out of the so-called silent majority period of the 1960s, country music began to be touted as a music of the common man and of the working man. And so the songwriters and singers began to exploit that notoriety or visibility, I guess, and all kinds of songs began to appear. And, of course, Haggard was responsible for a lot of them, but this guy, Aaron Tippin, who had been an industrial worker, I think from Georgia, and very nationalistic, very, very patriotic, even jingoistic in his attitudes toward American military involvement, that sort of thing. He did a song called Working Man's PhD, and I think it's a very strong fusion of machismo and working-class pride. So it's very unlike a lot of the stuff that Merle Haggard has done. It's anti-fatalistic. It's opposed to this idea that we're bound by dead-end jobs. This guy is saying, I'm proud of what I've done. And the rest of the country ought to be proud of it, too. You ought to look around and see the fruits of what working men have done.
So this is Aaron Tippin, the Working Man's PhD.
A long, hard day sure ain't much fun, but you gotta get it started. 40.